listening to One to One with Paul Costello, a podcast from the Stanford School of Medicine.
According to the National Institute of Mental Health Director Thomas Insull, nearly one in five Americans meets the criteria for a diagnosis of psychiatric illness in any given year. It also costs the country $193.2 billion in lost earnings per year. Stanford psychiatrist Ahmed Etkin is seeking to change the current state of treatment for mental health. He is collaborating with other Stanford scientists to map the origins of mental illnesses in the brain and develop non-invasive technologies to treat the conditions. In this podcast, Etkin will discuss the prevalence of mental illness in the United States and how he hopes the work he and his colleagues are doing will lead to improved treatments for depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Etkin is an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences and co-leader of the NeuroCircuit Initiative at Stanford University. Ahmed Etkin, thank you for joining me in One-to-One. I wanted to start with the crash of the German Wings aircraft and the conversations that it's opened about mental illness, suicide, and depression. And in a moment like this, being a psychiatrist, what do you think? And what's not being said that you think should be said?
Well, a lot of the coverage that you read talks about medical illness and mental illness as two separate things. So did somebody disclose their mental illness? Were they treated for something? What are the dangers of it? And part of the discussion that's really not being had is what does it mean to have a mental illness in terms of how we understand the illness, how we treat the illness, what's our relationship to these illnesses? So we know, for example, if you have diabetes, it's a disease with relatively little stigma, with relatively little overlay on it. If you have a mental illness like depression, or what may have been depression in this pilot, it's hard for the public still to make up their minds as to what they think of it. Do they think of it as the same as a medical illness, a disease of the brain, and you should approach that much like you do diabetes or anything that might alter the person's physiology? Or is that something that is more to do with their personality, their specific attributes, and you treat that differently?
Mm-hmm.
In the coverage right now, there's a tremendous tension between should they have prevented him from flying, besides all the issues of what they knew in advance and what they know now, but related to his illness, how do you actually understand that illness in the context of making any decisions, both for treatment, for allowing somebody like that to fly a plane, and for the public perception of just simply accepting that he has an illness?
Do times like these end up being further stigmatizing times, or are they moving targets in that we don't know right now if this is a period that will have opened a conversation or basically further stigmatize mental illness?
Most likely, judging based on recent experience, it won't be a period that will further destigmatize the illness. The reason I say that is because it comes in the context of tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody has to accept blame in a way for the tragedy. So that already colors the kind of conversation you could have.
Mm-hmm.
It would be nice if there were more of an open conversation and it didn't come in the context of a tragedy. Let's say it were revealed that a president had actually suffered for a long time from depression, was public about it. That would be something that would change the conversation. I think, unfortunately, the context mm-hmm. of this event,
the violent context of this,
exactly.
the murder
of 150
right,
people. I mean,
right.
It's just the sheer tragedy right. of the event itself.
Right. You know, when I heard you speak recently, you talked about many of the great achievements over the past number of years and in the treatment of many diseases. And you've just mentioned, you know, HIV and others, cancer. But yet when it comes to mental illness, you said since Prozac was introduced in 1987, there's really not been significant progress in mental illness and mental disorders and understanding the roots and how we get to really great treatments for mental illness. Why not? What's halted that? Why not significant progress?
There's a couple of reasons why there hasn't been significant progress. On the one hand, when we study patients, we've been limited in many ways actually by our thinking. So we've been taught to believe by the way diagnoses are made that a diagnosis of, say, depression or post-traumatic stress or schizophrenia is something based, when you base it on checklists of symptoms, that reflects the real world outside. That is, that that diagnosis is distinct from another diagnosis. And so that's biased the way we've done our research studies in humans, doing brain imaging, genetics, what have you. Only recently, in looking across diagnoses, have insights started to come out. So, for example, insights on the genetic basis of autism or schizophrenia. But the other side of it is actually from the animal work side. So we create animal models of human diseases. In many cases, these animal models have been created for the purpose of understanding how our medications work. So they become animal models of how a medication acts rather than an animal model of a pathology that a medication might impact upon. And both of these areas, the human neuroscience and the animal neuroscience, have been progressing, but the progress has really only been recent in that we've been able to break some of our conceptual barriers and start to really look outside of the box. Clearly, just looking inside the box has not brought the kind of treatments that have changed outcomes for patients in decades.
So talk about outside the box.
So outside the box looks in a couple ways, I think, very appealing. Outside the box says, don't think of disorders as handed down to you as truths, but question everything you already think. So question what a diagnosis is. What is the spectrum between risk, illness, and a well state? What are things that we would consider as comorbidities, that is, having two diagnoses? Are they really different expressions of the same underlying factor? So really dig at truth in essentially how nature would carve itself at its joints rather than how we impose that upon it. Thinking outside the box would also say, think about individualized biology. So it matters less, for example, whether you have a diagnosis, say depression, but rather what your particular impairments are in particular brain circuits that underlie particular behaviors and particular symptoms within that context of, let's call it depression or schizophrenia or what have you. And so then that actually would lead to a more personal biology that's both more explanatory and can guide interventions better.
But how is that happening today in many circumstances? I mean, when someone goes to see a psychotherapist to begin treatment, that brain imaging is usually not done.
That's right.
More often it's not done. So where are we at linking the understanding of the brain with traditional treatments, either medication or psychotherapy?
See, it's a really interesting question because on the one hand, on the research side, we're making inroads. So there's now multiple large treatment prediction biomarker type studies out there across any number of domains trying to link biology to current treatments. On the other hand, you have clinicians who don't have any of those tools, and those tools haven't yet been validated anyway. However, those clinicians listen to their patients, and they listen to specific complaints, specific issues that those patients have. So in a way, they're asking for the tools to be given, and they're almost ready for it without understanding fully what they're ready for or what the biology really says. But they already have that sense that personalization needs to happen.
What do we know about the roots of mental illness so far? Is there any common biological basis for mental illness?
We understand something about most mental illnesses that we think is pretty much certain, which is that mental illnesses reflect an interaction between things you bring in, your genetics, your early rearing childhood experiences, and the environment's influence on you. How those things come together and determine which particular illness you have and what its course then becomes a separate and interesting question. If you start looking at the kinds of symptoms people have across illnesses, they seem to fall into a number of smaller categories. It's not an infinite number of categories. And those categories reflect core biology. So biology of reward, biology of your how you pay attention to things and resist distractors and so forth. Even beyond that, there seems to be common biology across many illnesses related to how you tell whether something is important in the world around you and either pay attention to it or encode it into memory. And so you can start seeing how taking simpler building blocks, simpler brain circuits, that is, and having differential effects across these within an individual and across individuals can lead to different clinical presentations, but ultimately boil down to fewer biological blocks.
Do psychiatric disorders carry the same or similar brain structures? Like if one has depression and one has anxiety disorder or PTSD or whatever the range of the psychiatric disorder, is the brain structure similar?
So there's both similarities and differences, but what's more surprising to me is actually the similarities. So differences you would predict because these things are symptomatically somewhat different. So it stands to reason there would be some differences. We just published a study where we looked at the other question, whether there's similarities. A DSM, or Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the diagnostic Bible for psychiatry, would suggest that there would be no broad similarities across things like schizophrenia, drug addiction, bipolar, and depression. But as it turns out, there is. When you look at the literature on structural imaging, that is brain structure, and do a quantitative analysis across the entirety of this literature, which is something we just did and published, you find that there is actually a commonality across all these disorders, and that is loss within not just random regions, but one well-understood brain circuit. Gray matter or brain tissue is lost differentially across disorders, so it's lost more in schizophrenia, for example, than depression. But it's still the same brain circuit. So it starts to inform us about surprising commonalities. These commonalities can then become targets for intervention or can simply be a way to understand what makes you impaired in a mental illness, the reason basically that it is an illness, as opposed to just how you process information that's an idiosyncratic expression.
So how far are we along in this precision of understanding and the connection between emotion, brain, neurons, plasticity, and to connect that all together into effective treatments and outcomes?
We're not there, but we're not that far away. A lot of the problem in the field has been that our studies have been very small. And so when you do a study on 20 people, 30 people, you get a certain answer, and that answer is essentially the only thing you can detect, which is the big effect that you have there. Unfortunately, that big effect often doesn't replicate all that well. Where the field is now moving to is larger studies, combining across multiple smaller studies or very large studies from the beginning that start to give more definitive answers. Those are the things that are going to make those links that we need and can rely upon, because right now the literature just doesn't give us the confidence to say that something that we find in one study will show up in the next and will be something you can then base an intervention on. There's too many connect the dots happening there.
So is it your belief that the brain's plasticity is, I don't know what the correct word would be, moved, gelled, changed by psychotherapy and by medication?
Yeah, I think most of the story of psychiatric treatments is about plasticity. You can see that in a couple of examples. Medications, which we think of as things that elevate mood, let's say antidepressants, turn out when you give them to animals to change plasticity in their brains, that is capacity for change, whether that's in the part of their brain that underlies vision or their reaction to fear and trauma-like stimuli. So it allows their brains to learn better. Psychotherapy, likewise, works on your ability to learn new information and change your patterns of behavior. We also have non-invasive forms of brain stimulation, something called repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation, or RTMS, which has been FDA approved for the treatment of depression. That, too, directly works on plasticity. So if you think of psychiatric disorders as essentially brain circuit disorders or brain circuit arrhythmia, something's wrong with the rhythm of these circuits, the interconnections and intercommunications, then altering how regions of the brain talk to each other through plasticity whether it's through medication, psychotherapy, or brain stimulation, should be a common way to exert therapeutic change.
What do you tell people about the effectiveness of medication? When a patient comes to you and says, you know, I think I should go on medication, my problems are there constantly or there have been there for a period of time, what do you tell them about the effectiveness?
So medications, if we're talking about antidepressants primarily here, have been shown to be effective mostly for the more severe patients. Primarily, that's an issue with how you measure change. So we just, for people who are less symptomatic, we just don't know that there's as much change because they're just simply less symptomatic. But the role of medications is complicated. So in somebody who I see clinically, I would never just give them a medication and that's it, they're out the door. I'd have them understand the changes that that medication brings in them and in their brain and in their lives, so that they're able to take advantage of it, going after this idea of plasticity. I never want a patient to leave and think, I got this medication and the medication made me better and I had no role in it. It is their experience and reshaping their experience and their expectations of the world, perhaps aided by a medication or could be aided by other factors that allows them to change and then allows them to maintain that change.
Ketamine is a psychotropic medication that is now being researched and a lot of fanfare and buzz about it. How does it work?
So ketamine blocks a particular kind of glutamate receptor. So glutamate is the main neurotransmitter, the main way that brain cells communicate with each other throughout the brain. And what ketamine does is essentially reset or change the activity of glutamate in many, many parts of the brain. So it's something that's given intravenously, and it's you don't need anesthesia or anything, but it's given intravenously and has a very potent psychotropic effect. But it also seems to have an effect on depression. In fact, the exciting finding that's really motivating the interest in ketamine is that it has an effect on depression within hours or days, whereas traditional antidepressants work within weeks.
Mm-hmm. So as far as the study of ketamine, where is that and how quickly is that advancing? Is it? It's not FDA approved at this point, is it?
It's an anesthetic given to dogs or animals in general. As well as a club drug. It's not something that's going to be, I don't think, FDA approved for depression. It just has too many negative side effects, or its effects are too negative in many ways.
Because it's also a psychedelic drug.
Exactly. And it could lead people, for example, with schizophrenia to have hallucinations at a lower threshold. So that was one early piece of evidence that said that NMDA, this particular type of glutamate receptor, is important for schizophrenia, is that you give a low dose of ketamine to somebody who's schizophrenic and it launches them into psychosis, whereas a healthy person doesn't get launched into psychosis. So I think in many ways, ketamine is something that might point the direction that we want to go.
So it's never going to go before the FDA because of its power, its the raw changes, the raw impact of it.
That's right, and it's addictive.
A lot of issues.
Exactly, it's a drug of abuse. You can become addicted to it. It has effects on more than just the glutamate system. It has effects like an opiate, like morphine, and so all of those things preclude any regular use. And of course, getting something IV is not particularly the ideal route that we want.
So the window into looking at ketamine is that to understand the relationship of glutamate to psychosocial disorders, is that sort of the study of it is to find what in ketamine and what in glutamate really instigates or calms down or changes mental disorders.
That's right. So it says that there's something in ketamine that's an active agent, which may be the opiate effects or maybe the glutamate effects or maybe other effects entirely. But most importantly, what it does is it says that antidepressant treatment shouldn't take 2 months, mm-hmm. that you shouldn't be satisfied with giving a drug to your patient and saying, you know what, in 6 to 8 weeks, we'll see if it's working. We've been acculturated to think that this is okay in the field, but ultimately really is not okay. You don't want to go to your doctor and have a problem that's pressing, that's maybe driving you to be suicidal. And the answer is, well, let's see how this works in 6 to 8 weeks. I think ketamine says that it's possible to have a faster effect. And frankly, we know it's possible to have a faster effect through all the work done on electroconvulsive therapy, or ECT, formerly known as shock therapy, which can have antidepressant effects, again, within days or 2 weeks at most. You can see very striking effects for very, very depressed people. So there shouldn't be a reason to accept the status quo.
What is the most interesting research today, either medication or psychotherapy, for anxiety disorder?
For anxiety disorders, the most effective treatments have always been psychotherapies. Where people are going in particular areas of research within anxiety disorders and psychotherapy is seeing if, by understanding how that psychotherapy works, we can augment it in different ways. So can we give a drug that allows you to encode the memory of the psychotherapy session better? Especially if you just had a good session, you want that to be encoded better. There are animal models for certain aspects of psychotherapy, something we call extinction, or the learning that a negative outcome is not associated with a cue, a reminder, let's say, of a trauma or a social situation or something that might make you feel anxious. That bringing of neuroscience into psychotherapy and using medications together with psychotherapy is a great mix, showing how a brain basis informs a kind of treatment that no longer can be categorized as simply meds or therapy or both. It is a brain-directed, circuit-informed treatment that has flexible tools, and they happen to look like psychotherapy or medication or non-invasive brain stimulation, but these are just tools to affect the brain.
What would Freud say today if he could look at the state of treatment for mental illnesses, mental disorders? Would he be shocked? Would he be surprised? What would he see as great progress, and where would he see the gaps?
It's an interesting question, because I think on the one hand, as a clinician, he would be disappointed that people have not gotten fundamentally better now. I mean, fundamentally, I mean things like cures. We're not even close to cures now compared to 100 years ago when he lived. I mean, that's a long time if you think about the development of other areas of medicine. But Freud, in many ways, especially the early Freud, was a neurobiologist. His early work was actually to try to understand the brain basis, in his very, very rudimentary science at the time, of the things he saw clinically. I think that would make him happy, that now there's a connecting of things, grounding in the brain, that there wasn't a couple decades ago. This is really a relatively new development with brain imaging. And that, and accepting and understanding different kinds of tools grounded in the brain, I think would make him quite happy.
PTSD is a huge problem for returning veterans from the Middle East, from Afghanistan, Iraq. Can you talk about some of the treatments that are being used today that are the most successful?
So hands down, the most successful treatment for PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder, is psychotherapy. There's a couple different forms of psychotherapy, and I think people can debate in the field whether they're really substantively different from each other, but fundamentally it's psychotherapy. There's some evidence for effectiveness of medication, more of it in civilians than in veterans, and there's also some evidence for effectiveness of brain stimulation. But right now, the best way to get treatment to a veteran or a civilian with PTSD is psychotherapy. But the barriers to getting people into psychotherapy are very substantial.
And you're talking about stigmas being the most significant one, or price, or access, or all of the above?
All of the above, and add on to that training. So stigma is always a major one, especially amongst veterans. It's a major, major issue and a huge barrier to getting any kind of care. Military populations are very hard to access. They go through... essentially through their experience in the military, training that this is not something that you can express.
Told to be tough.
And, you know, frankly, if you're in the middle of a war zone, you don't have time to think about yourself. You have a job to do. You have a mission to carry out. And so there is a hard juggling that has to be done between being in a war zone and coming back home. But a lot of other things are barriers too. So for example, the best psychotherapies for PTSD are things that are well done within the VA, but very little of it in the community, and many veterans won't go to the VA. And so if they don't have access to somebody who knows the psychotherapy, then even if they're getting therapy, they may not be getting the right one.
What is TMS, and how have you studied it, and how have you used it?
TMS stands for transcranial magnetic stimulation. And essentially, you're running an electric current, a powerful electric current, through a magnet, through an electromagnet that's placed outside the head. And what that does for you is it non-invasively passes a magnetic field into the brain and activates the bit of brain underneath it. So in other words, non-invasively, you can actually turn on and turn off little parts of the brain. What we've done is combine that with brain imaging so that we can see the effects of what we're doing. It turns out if you do TMS to most parts of the brain, the person won't be able to tell you what happened and won't be able to tell you an experiential change. So you have to combine that with imaging.
Do you see a future of that someone will walk into a clinic and the first thing they'll be asked is not to sit down and talk to a psychiatrist or a therapist, but they'll have brain imaging done, an MRI, some sort of sophisticated brain imaging, and then the physician, the psychiatrist will review that, and then they'll sit down, and then they'll have a discussion.
So I think that, like much of medicine, there's going to be a triaging and multi-level process. So much of, let's say, depression will still be seen by primary care docs, and they'll be primarily prescribing medications because that's the one tool that's accessible to them. They don't really have access to psychotherapy or brain stimulation or imaging or any of it. Once you've failed that first line, cheaper, easier treatment, then you come to a psychiatrist and you get a more full evaluation. For somebody who's failed many treatments or somebody whose treatment course is more challenging because of comorbidities, let's say, then absolutely it might be quite useful to have a brain imaging done, brain imaging session. And the way to think about what that buys you then is essentially tells you not only about their brain, but then about targets in their brain for treatment, for example, using TMS. So combining the imaging of the organ with a tool that can affect the organ could be a lot more powerful than just blindly applying these tools without that information.
What are some of the chief falsehoods about mental illness that you think that we really need to grapple with and erase? At one point, it was believed that there were schizophrenic mothers who created schizophrenic children. And that was a belief, a scientific belief, a theoretical proposition. And it's been discovered to be completely false. What do you think are those same sort of things that probably are further stigmatizing someone from seeking treatment because they hear sort of crazy things about mental illness or about, you know, how one becomes mentally ill or effective treatments for mental illness?
You know, stigma is a very hard thing to fight. In part, stigma comes from the person themselves, that they experience the illness not as a blood test that shows high sugar, but as a personal experience. And so it's hard to separate yourself from your illness at that point. But I think the big thing that would change either our view of causes or stigma or encourage people to go seek treatment is a much more explanatory biology where it's neutral. There's no judgment passed. If your anterior cingulate doesn't work as well as somebody else's, it's just your brain and that's how it works. And that might be then the target for treatment and help you function better in your life. But there's no judgment there. There's no need for emotion and valence just to describe your brain, just like you wouldn't describe your liver or your kidney in kind of emotional terms and tisk-tisk at somebody who has diabetes. They have diabetes, you solve the problem with an intervention.
And what we're really learning now about mental disorders is that early childhood trauma has a significant impact upon one's life later on, that anxiety disorders, depression, a whole realm of psychiatric disorders come from, you know, early perhaps abuse, sexual abuse, you know, cruelty, et cetera, bullying, all these things because of the brain and how the brain reacts to them, trigger psychiatric disorders throughout life.
Yeah, one of the fascinating things about early life events is on the one hand, the brain's actually quite resilient. You could do a lot and the person, the average person, can recover well. But if the brain doesn't recover well, you have too much of certain negative events, that shapes everything and colors everything in this kind of broadly ramifying way throughout life. So it puts you at risk for certain disorders. It puts you at risk for having multiple disorders. It puts you at risk for responding less well to treatment. A very, very negative broad effect that you don't have, for example, if you had a trauma in adulthood. It's really a period of sensitivity for the brain to both learn, on the one hand, to be resilient, or to be overwhelmed and develop that risk for illness later on.
Why are you a psychiatrist? Why are you interested in the research of the brain and the research of psychiatric disorders? What interested you?
It's the most interesting thing out there. I've always been interested in behavior and how people think and why they think certain things and why they feel certain things. And it's always struck me as a biological question that's inherently tied with lots of philosophical and broadly psychological questions. Ultimately, I think I can do, in terms of research, more good in this domain than in any other domain I can come up with. But it's that interface between biology and the feeling of the mind and the philosophy of the mind that's really, really interesting and the biggest questions out there, both in terms of science and in terms of clinical medicine.
And do you feel we're on the precipice of this renaissance, this great revolution?
Yeah, we're into it now. I think we're not even on the precipice. We're
further along than the decade of the brain. And
yeah, announcing decades of anything, I think, is a problem to begin with. The decade of the brain was announced really prematurely, and I wouldn't suggest announcing a decade of anything anytime soon. It certainly has not worked out in the best way for cancer either when that was announced, but it builds excitement. I think we are now at the point in psychiatry and in neuroscience relevant to behavior and emotion where we finally have some of the tools we need to answer the questions that we want to answer and no longer as limited by not having had those tools. The best examples are, for example, having imaging, a very sophisticated imaging set of imaging methods in humans, having tools in animals to allow us to manipulate fine elements of brain circuits, and then taking those ideas, for example, in the way that we're doing in the lab now, combining TMS and brain imaging to manipulate circuits in humans. That going back and forth and asking questions with the right tools will allow very, very big questions to be answered, important advances to be made in the treatment of psychiatric disorders, and ultimately realize the promise that everybody holds for the field, given this nexus between biology and philosophy and psychology.
Amit Etkin, thank you for joining me on One to One.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
The preceding program is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of Stanford University. One to One is produced by the School of Medicine's Office of Communication and Public Affairs. For more information, please visit us at mednews.stanford.edu.